What we're going to do first today is an example from the homework, because we've gotten through a lot of the essentials of redox reactions, talked about oxidation states, what is oxidation, what is reduction. And so I wanted to practice figuring out what is the oxidizing agent in a reaction, what's the reducing agent, what's getting oxidized, what's getting reduced. So this is from problem 21 in your text. And it's a chemical reaction involving some ions that you're not familiar with. This first one is a variant of sulfate called thiosulfate. And it can react with oxygen in an acid environment in order to make another ion known as the tetrathionate ion. Plus, it ends up generating water. So if you're given an equation like this, in order to figure out what's being oxidized, what's being reduced, we have to come up with the oxidation state for each atom. So you know that we went over a few rules the other day about determining oxidation states. And just let me remind you what some of those rules are. First, if you have a single atom that's an ion, the charge is the same as the oxidation state. So, for example, we have H+, which is just a monatomic ion, and so we automatically know that since it was a plus one ion, it has a plus one oxidation state. If you have elements that have not yet reacted, that means they haven't gained or lost any electrons. And so if we look at O2 here, we know that's an element. And so that means it's automatically going to have a zero oxidation state. Now, outside of that, we have some rules for hydrogen and oxygen. And they're based on electronegativity. So oxygen is usually more electronegative than whatever it's attached to. And so if we look at this thiosulfate, the first substance here, the negative 2 goes for the whole substance, but each oxygen on its own is going to have its regular negative 2 oxidation state. So then one of the other rules is that whatever the total of all the oxidation states is in a substance, that's got to equal the total charge. So if we want to figure out what sulfur's oxidation state is, we've got to look at the fact that thiosulfate as a whole is a negative 2 charge, and each oxygen is going to have an oxidation state of negative 2. And so what we could do is break it apart like this. We could say there are two sulfurs, and there's the three oxygens, and those oxidation states all have to add up to negative 2, the overall charge. And I'd already said that oxygen is going to have its normal oxidation state of negative 2. So if we simplify, we get that two sulfurs minus six is equal to negative two. And so that means the two sulfurs together are going to have a plus four oxidation state. So each sulfur in that first substance is going to have a plus two oxidation state. So we've got everything on the left-hand side of the equation. Now we'll flip over to the other side. So in water, water follows the normal rules for oxidation states in that oxygen, because it's more electronegative, is going to have a negative 2 oxidation state. And most substances that have hydrogen, hydrogen is less electronegative. So when doing that electron count, it's going to lose its electrons. And so we end up with a plus 1 oxidation state. So the fact we've got two plus 1s and a negative 2 means it all adds up to 0, which is what it should be because water is a neutral molecule. So the last thing we need to do is check on the peroxydisulfate, or the tetrathionate, I'm sorry. Again, we're going to have oxygen with its regular oxidation state of negative 2, and so we can do the same analysis here like we did for this first substance. Now there are four sulfurs and six oxygens that all have to add up to a negative 2 overall. And again, with oxygen being a negative 2, we could substitute, And we get 4 times the sulfur plus 12, or minus 12, is equal to negative 2. So then we get 4 of the sulfurs is equal to 10, which means each sulfur is effectively 2.5, which it doesn't make sense exactly because you can't have a half charge. But what's really going on is that there are 2 different kinds of sulfurs in the compound, which we can't tell from the structure. When I say 2 different sulfurs, sulfurs that are connected in 2 different ways. But we can still take this overall average oxidation state to be able to answer the question of what got oxidized, what got reduced. So what is oxidation? In terms of electrons, what is oxidation? Well, it's when you lose electrons. So from these oxidation states, can we tell what lost electrons? Well, what ended up going more positive in terms of oxidation state? Well, it's the sulfur, because even if it's an average, we go from plus 2 to plus 2.5. So if the oxidation state increases, that means electrons were lost. So OS, I'm going to use to abbreviate for oxidation state. If the oxidation state increases, that means electrons were lost. That means that the sulfur was oxidized. Then in any kind of redox reaction, if something loses electrons, something has to gain electrons. There has to be a balance there. So there is something here that ended up effectively gaining electrons, which is what? The oxygen, that's right. Because if we look at the oxygen, it goes from 0 to a negative 2, regardless of which substance we're looking at. So the oxidation state decreased, which means electrons were gained, and so that means that we have reduction. So the sulfur, just to write out in text form, the sulfur in S2O3-2 had its oxidation state increased, so the substance S2O3-2 was oxidized. This means, though, that the S2O3, the thiosulfate, was the reducing agent. Why? Because a reducing agent or reducer is something that provides electrons. So the sulfur provided electrons. So from one perspective, we call it a reducing agent. But if we're focusing on the sulfur itself, we say the sulfur lost electrons, so it was oxidized. Now you have the same story that you could tell for the oxygen in O2. So the oxygen in O2 had its oxidation state decreased. So the O2 was reduced. And that means that the O2 was the oxidizing agent. Which makes sense. I mean, the term oxidation itself makes it sound like it's always a reaction of oxygen. It's not, but it very frequently is. And so oxygen is on the right-hand side of the periodic table. It is the second most electronegative element. So it makes sense that it would want to gain electrons. So if it gained electrons, we say it was reduced, but from another perspective, we could say it also stole electrons, which means it's an oxidizing agent, which is extremely logical. Oxygen almost always acts, elemental oxygen almost always acts as an oxidizing agent. So did anyone have any questions about how I came up with the oxidation states or how I determined what was oxidized, what was reduced, what was the oxidizer, what was the reducer? Okay, so we are ahead of where we're supposed to be in the syllabus, and in fact, we're going to get a little bit more ahead today because I want to move into one of the next chapters so that I make sure that I have time to be able to talk about it. So we're supposed to be coming back and talking about batteries. I'll probably do that on Tuesday when we come back. But I wanted to move to the next chapter, which is on organic compounds or organic chemistry in general. So the term organic loosely means that it's related to compounds that contain carbon. And that's because we are carbon-based compounds. I mean, we are largely made of water, but as far as biological tissues and such, the main component or the main chemistry that goes on involves carbon. So by extension, organic refers to nearly any substance that has carbon in it. Organic chemistry is its own separate branch of chemistry only because it is mainly about the behavior of carbon. So I probably haven't talked about chemistry as a field at all, but there's several major divisions in the field of chemistry. One is inorganic chemistry, which means the chemistry of everything that isn't carbon, which is, of course, the rest of the periodic table. So it's an awfully large branch. But organic chemistry is given its own branch because it is the foundation of biological chemistry, medicinal chemistry. So it is its own large venture in its own. There is what's known as physical chemistry. That's where you look at how chemical reactions occur, how quickly they occur, how physically do the reactions occur. Physical chemistry often involves a lot of measurement. And then there is also what's known as computational chemistry, which is where we come up with computer models to try to predict what might happen in chemical reactions, how can we track the energy in a set of molecules as they react. So organic is one of the major branches, and your text gives a very good general introduction to the topic of organic chemistry. So what we need to do first is talk a little bit about what structures look like, which you have fortunately had Lewis dot structures, so we know how to come up with the structures of simple molecules, but organic molecules are often very large molecules. So there's another way to notate their structures. So let me build up to that by first saying that carbon almost always reacts to have a total of four bonds. And the buzzword used to describe that is tetravalent. So valent or valency means to have control over, and so tetravalent means having control over four things, in this case, four bonds. And so the simplest types of compounds that involve carbon are what are known as hydrocarbons. So a hydrocarbon is a substance that only contains carbon and hydrogen. So you've seen the simplest example of a carbohydrate, because I've talked about the molecule methane before. And I think in a problem where we were doing combustion, I brought up the molecule propane. The difference between the two molecules is how many carbons the substance contains. So methane is a compound that only contains one carbon. Propane is a compound that contains three carbons. These are both of a family of substances known as alkanes. So alkanes are hydrocarbons that only contain single bonds. Why does that matter? Well, because hydrocarbons with only single bonds, they don't tend to be as reactive as substances that have double bonds or triple bonds. That doesn't mean they can't react in some way, and actually a lot of simple hydrocarbons end up being fuels. For example, if you've heard anything about gas before, you might have heard the term octane, which the way that that term's used in referring to gas is a little bit different, but octane itself is just another hydrocarbon. The oct part of that name does mean eight, and so the simplest version of octane is something that has eight carbons all connected in a row. Now, as you can tell, it gets a little tedious writing the structures of larger molecules like this out, because you've got to write in all the bond lines, write in all the hydrogens, write in all the carbons. So this is where I wanted to introduce another way of writing structures. And this way of writing structures is only used in organic compounds because it's a writing system for carbon. And one of the ways to refer to these types of structures are line structures. So line structures are simplified Lewis dot structures used for representing organic compounds. And your text does use a combination of regular Lewis dot structures where we write everything out and write the lines, but it also does use these simplified structures, which, with a little bit of practice, really make it much quicker to write out the structure of molecules and to read the structure of molecules. So I did want to take a moment to explain the rules for writing line structures. So the first rule is that normally the carbon atomic labels, each C that you would normally write, is left out. And, not always, but normally, hydrogens attached to carbons are completely left out, both the atomic labels and the bond lines themselves. So what would that mean for a substance like octane? Well, here's the way that we would draw octane in line structure form. Takes of a heck of a lot less time to write, doesn't it? The zigzag structure, I'll explain in a minute where that comes from. Because you see that for octane itself, in its Lewis dot structure form, we write it more in crosswise fashion, left, right, up, down. But there's a physical reason why when we write line structures, we do this zigzagging instead. So what about reading line structures? You know, say that you saw this line structure, how do we know it's octane? Well, anywhere where the structure changes shape, or anywhere where you have an end of the structure, or any point where an atomic label is missing, that's a better way of saying it, it's automatically assumed to be carbon. And why? Because that's what the system is for, to be a rapid way of writing carbon structures. So any point on the structure that is missing an atomic label is automatically assumed to be carbon. So looking at the line structure I drew out, the very end of the structure that's missing a carbon or missing an atomic label, so it's a carbon. Here where it changes direction, where it comes up to a point, a bond can't just in space turn around and change directions it's going. So that point in the structure is another carbon. So if you count all the points here, there are 8 different places that the atom labels are missing, and those correspond to the 8 carbons in octane. Now, what about all the hydrogens? Well, this structure writing is based off the way that carbon compounds normally react. So for most substances, carbon either has bonds to other carbons or to hydrogens or to other atoms. If we did have other atoms like oxygen or nitrogen, we don't leave those out. So that's another rule that I maybe could write down, is to say that these simplification rules, they only apply to carbon or to hydrogen. Everything else you write out explicitly. So if you don't have a bunch of bond lines to show what's connected to carbon, carbon is still assumed to have 4 bonds to it. And naturally, what would end up happening is the default is that the carbon is connected to other hydrogens. So the assumption is this. If a carbon has less than 4 bonds shown, it is automatically assumed there are hydrogens attached to bring that bond count to 4. That's why I started out by saying that carbon is normally a tetravalent atom. It's something that likes to be connected to 4 other things. So again, if we look up at this line structure, where my pen currently is at the very left-hand side of the structure, the fact that we have a line here going any direction means that it's a carbon-carbon bond. But if you look at that, that means that the carbon at the very end only has 1 bond drawn in. And so we automatically assume that there are three hydrogens attached to that point, which we can see in the more fully expanded structure. Yes, there really are three hydrogens at that position. If we look at the next carbon over, where this zigzag reaches a point, well, there are two lines coming off of that position, so they would represent two carbon-carbon bonds. That means there's two bonds not being shown, and they're automatically assumed to be hydrogen, which is exactly what we've got here. So we might do next time a little practice going back and forth between line structures. You're not going to be expected to handle any really complicated molecules, but if I wanted to show you examples of compounds, because you know eventually we're going to get to talking about things that are biologically based, like blood sugar, which is glucose. That's a organic molecule that contains several oxygens on it. So suppose I wanted to write that structure out. It would take a while to do with all the bond lines like this, but it's pretty quick to do if I do in the line structure format. So more I'm interested in, can you just interpret a structure of something that might be somewhat biologically interesting? So I know I've kind of done this, I've sort of babbled a little bit about organic compounds, but that's because we got to start somewhere talking about their structure. So just to summarize what I've talked about so far, the simplest types of compounds that contain carbon are the hydrocarbons, substances that only have carbon and hydrogen, propane like in propane tanks, methane which is swamp gas or natural gas, butane which you have in butane lighters. Those are all examples of alkanes. And the gas that you put in a gas-burning car, a large component of that gas is also these simple types of hydrocarbons. So aside from just showing you the simple hydrocarbons, I'm actually showing you a subset of what are known as alkanes. Those are compounds that only have carbon-carbon single bonds in them. And just to get somewhere, I've talked about the structure writing format, where we can write things out in what are known as line structures that make it way simpler, way quicker to write out organic compounds. Now, let me just briefly explain why these line structures tend to be zigzag in format. So if I did have something like propane, if I write it out in full Lewis dot structure form, it would look like this, where it would look like all the bond angles are 90 degrees to each other. But what is the true geometry around each one of the carbons based on what you had learned previously? So now ignore the fact that we have carbon-carbon versus carbon-hydrogen bonds. Let's say the bonds are not different enough to cause a distortion in shape. So if you have carbon with four bonds around it, what shape would that be? Tetrahedral, right? Remember our simple shapes from Vesper theory? So tetrahedral shape means it's a pyramidal type of shape. So let's say that we got one carbon that's in the center here that has hydrogens that are in a tetrahedral arrangement. Well, if you got another carbon that's connected to that first carbon, then it's also going to have a kind of tetrahedral arrangement. And that's attached to another carbon that has a tetrahedral arrangement to it. So I'm not drawing this very well at all, but if I had a little bit better drawing ability or if I had a model set, what you would see is that if you link a bunch of tetrahedrons together, that the carbons would automatically end up in a zigzag type of shape. So the zigzag shape of many organic molecules, the way we write them down, is due to the fact that carbon with four bonds is tetrahedral in shape. So let me write that out in word form. So the zigzag shape that many organic molecules have when written is due to the fact that carbon with four bonds I'll make it more specific, four single bonds has a tetrahedral shape. Now, the start of your chapter goes over exactly what I've shown here, that you have compounds called alkanes, and it very quickly gets to the point where it shows you line structures as well. But it does go over some other important terminology that I'd like to introduce to you. So there's a relationship between certain types of molecules known as isomers. Has anybody ever heard of the term isomer before? It's probably not something you encountered even if you've had chemistry before. No. Okay, so isomers are molecules with the exact same chemical formula but different structures. Molecules with the same chemical formula, but different structures. So let me show you a simple example of that. Oh, sorry, question.
So would that be like graphite and diamond?
That's a different term, actually. So when a graphite and diamond are both different forms of carbon itself. And so those are called allotropes. Allotropes are when you have different physical forms of an element. So there's actually three major forms that carbon exists in: diamond, graphite, and something known as buckyball or Buckminster fullerene, which I know is an odd term, but what that looks like is a sort of soccer ball shape. If you've ever heard the reference to something called C60, carbon 60, these are arrangements of carbons that adopt these geometric patterns, and one of them literally looks like what you would see if you had a soccer ball. If you took a soccer ball and all the hexagons and pentagons, you put carbons at each one of those points, there's a molecule that looks just like that, and that's one of the essential forms of carbon, which there has been a lot of research to take advantage of these shapes, which maybe I can tell that story some other time, but that's related to the term allotrope. So another example of allotropes would be if you look at O2, which is breathable oxygen, and then O3, which is ozone. They're both just forms of oxygen. They're both technically elemental forms, but one keeps us alive, and one of them, the other, is lethal. So it's just two different forms of an element. So isomers are a little different. It's where you have a compound, so you've got multiple elements involved, and it's where you have the same chemical formula, but different structures. And there's several different types of isomers. So one type of isomer that's called a constitutional isomer is where you just change the way that atoms are connected to each other. So let me write out some simple examples. And this will give us a chance to practice playing with line structures as well. So let's just do a little quick practice. In your notes, can you just take a couple of moments to see if you could read these line structures and translate them into fully written out Lewis dot structures? And so remember the rules. Anywhere where you see a change in the shape or you see a point that doesn't have an atomic label, there's a carbon that exists there. And then if you don't have four bonds written, there's hydrogens there to bring the total count up to four. So take a few seconds and see if you can convert these into Lewis dot structures. So if you look at the first one of these on the left, how many carbons are in it? Four? So actually it's three. And that's because the bond line that's on the right here that's written to oxygen, since we have an oxygen there, that is the atomic label that's supposed to be on that end of the bond. So if we write this out in full form, there are three carbons, and that right-hand carbon is attached to oxygen. Now notice that the hydrogen and oxygen is written in, and that's because the rules for line structures, we don't simplify atoms other than carbon. So, of course, the bond line is missing, and we can go ahead and put that in. Now notice that the lone pairs in oxygen, those are also not left out. So all the lone pairs would translate over. So now we'll put single bonds between the carbons, but we're still missing some bonds. So the left-hand carbon, how many hydrogens do we need to put on it in order to bring it up to the right number? Right, some of you are signaling to me three. And that's correct. What about the middle carbon? Two, that's right. And then the bottom carbon, the right-hand one, that's also going to be two. So if you count all this up, this has three carbons in it. It's got three, four, five, six, seven, eight hydrogens and one oxygen. So it's got the formula C3H8O. Now the compound on the right, it's also got three carbons in it, but this time the oxygen is attached on the middle carbon. That's why these two compounds, we're going to find out, are isomers. Because if we write all the other hydrogens in, it's going to turn out it has the same chemical formula as the compound on the left. So each of these carbons that are on the outside, each has three hydrogens because the carbon only has one bond shown to it. And then this middle carbon, it's already got three bonds shown, so there's one hydrogen missing. And if you count them up, then it's also got three carbons, eight hydrogens, and an oxygen. So these are isomers. Which means they would behave differently from each other. Now, one of these is something that you might have sitting on your shelf at home. The one on the right is what's known as isopropyl alcohol. So propyl, that prefix means three carbons. So propyl alcohol on the left here is what you get when you have a three-carbon compound with an OH group on it. And I'll talk about that OH group in just a moment. But the iso in isopropanol comes from that word isomer. So isopropyl alcohol, if you don't know what that means, that's rubbing alcohol. So in your medicine cabinet at home, you might have some of that, and it's this compound here. It's different from the propyl alcohol that behaves quite differently. So I'm just trying to give you an example where isomers show up and in everyday products like isopropyl alcohol. So we'll come back to that term alcohol in a minute. But I wanted to talk about another type of isomer that I don't think is mentioned in your text. Let me just check really quickly here. It's a little bit more advanced concept, but it's a really, really important concept. So even if I don't quiz you about it, I'd like to talk to you about it. And it has to do with geometry. Oh, sorry, question.
So how would we label these in a chemical reaction? Because we couldn't tell the difference between the two without them being labeled.
So the question was brought up, if we're writing out a chemical reaction equation and we just write the chemical formula, how do we know which one it is? You can't. So if you're an organic chemist, you wouldn't write them out, the reactions, using the formulas. You'd use the line structures themselves. So in organic chemistry, we normally write out reaction equations in picture format, you could say, rather than in text format. Now, in text, there is a way to try to show a difference between the compounds. So your text does mention these things called condensed formulas. So the compound on the left here could be written CH3CH2CH2OH, because it shows how many hydrogens are attached to that specific carbon, and the assumption is one carbon is attached to the next. The compound on the right here could be written CH3CHOHCH3 to show the structure that the middle carbon has a hydrogen and an OH group attached, and then the other two carbons on either side have three hydrogens on them. So this is sometimes done if you're trying to represent things in text form. But if you're an organic chemist, you would just write the line structures out. Anyone else have questions before I move on? No, you don't need to know it. You do need to know what isomers in general are, though, that they're compounds with same formula, different structures. So I was about to tell the story of a different type of isomer. And it has to do with the fact that carbon's got a tetrahedral shape. So one other class of organic compounds are known as haloalkanes, which are alkanes that contain hydrogens. Did I just say hydrogens? That contain halogens, which means bromine, chlorine, fluorine, or iodine. You've probably heard of Teflon before, right? Teflon is a substance made up of a alkane that has fluorines all over it. And those carbon-fluorine bonds have a different reactivity to it that gives Teflon its ability to not have things stick to it. So Teflon is an example of a halogen-containing compound. Now here's a really simple haloalkane. It's got a bromine, a chlorine, and a fluorine on it. And I've used these bond lines before, these odd-looking lines, and I might have even told you what they're for in the past, but let me remind you. So this one here that looks like a thick triangle, that's what's known as a wedge bond, and it means that it's pointed towards us. And this other one is a dash bond, which means that that atom is pointed away. So if you had a tetrahedron, and maybe I should have brought a model to help show this. If you have a tetrahedron and you tried to put it into the plane of the paper, you could line up two of the atoms to be flat with the paper like this, but then automatically the other two are going to stick out. So one's going to point towards, one's going to point away. So these lines are used just to help show the three-dimensional structure. Now, this may really be difficult to see without building the model. So you'll just have to believe me at the moment that if I just on paper appear to flip which way that the atoms are written, you might be tempted to say, oh, well, that's the same molecule. But it turns out it's not. These two molecules are mirror images of each other. And like I said, this is a term that doesn't appear to be defined in your text, but I'd like you just to have been exposed to this. These are what are known as stereoisomers. So stereo, that term we think of like stereo sound, left and right. But the term stereo actually has to do with size or shape. So stereoisomers are isomers that are identical molecules with identical bond connectivity. Same atoms attached to the same atoms, but different arrangements in 3D space. So they're isomers that have the same bond connectivity. Same atoms attach the same atoms, but different three-dimensional arrangements. One of these molecules that I've drawn would be called a left-handed molecule, and the other one would be called a right-handed molecule. Which, you know, if you hold your left and right hands up, you can see that your hands are mirror images as well. And, of course, if you put your hands together palm to palm like this, your hands would appear to overlap. But if you kept your hands held out and you put one on top of the other, of course, they're not the same as each other. I mean, if you have a left and a right-handed glove, unless they're really cheap gloves, the left-handed glove's not going to fit in your right hand and vice versa. So that's an example of this stereoisomerism. So why am I taking the time to talk about this? Because it shows up all over the place in biology. I'm going to give you several different examples. I referred to glucose earlier, blood sugar. And it turns out that all of the different types of sugars, glucose, which is blood sugar, lactose, which is milk sugar, fructose, which is fruit sugar, maltose, which shows up in some beverages, they all have this handedness to them. They all have left and right hand forms. But it turns out biologically, it's only one of the forms that ends up being metabolized. So there's a left-handed glucose and a right-handed glucose, and your body has several defense mechanisms that, for example, in the brain won't even allow the wrong-handed version to cross into the brain. And it's an interesting question in terms of science, because it turns out that if you have mirror image molecules, almost every single physical property of those molecules are identical. They got the same color, the same density, the same everything. The only difference between the molecules is how they would twist light when light passes through it. So if these molecules are mirror images and they have all the identical behavior, why does it turn out that all life on the planet only uses one form? You know, depending on what your belief system is, if life developed over a long period of time, what was it thousands, millions of years ago that caused just one form of the molecule to be used and not the other? There is no clear answer to that yet. So sugars, they have a handedness like this. If you've heard of amino acids before, they have a handedness as well. So proteins, there's a left-handed version and a right-handed version. The body only uses one. The other just doesn't get metabolized. Going further than that, do you all know what enzymes are? Have you heard the term enzyme? That's known as a biological catalyst, which there must be a place that we get to talk about that later in the text. So these are huge molecules that help chemical reactions occur much more quickly than they would otherwise. Well, enzymes have handedness as well. So if a molecule is coming in to try to fit into an enzyme to react, it has to have the shape that matches. So that's why the stereoisomerization matters, because a lot of biological molecules have this handedness. I'll give you another example. This is way before your time or my time even, but it's one of the most classic examples in organic chemistry of this whole phenomenon. There was a medication that was used back, I think it was in the 50s and 60s, called thalidomide. And the reason it was used is it helped to cure morning sickness. But what they didn't realize at first is that there were two mirror image forms of the molecules. And one of them, yes, helped with morning sickness, and the other one caused fetal deformations. So if you were trying to cure morning sickness and use this medication, and if it was the wrong-handedness, it caused, I think it was thousands of children to be born with deformations, mainly in the limbs. The term that was used were flipper babies because they had malformed arms or legs. And I forget the full story, but I think it was in the manufacturing process of this medicine that's where the mistake was made, that they didn't realize that both of the forms were getting out in the medication. So if you look this up, you can read all about this whole case that occurred with the compound thalidomide. And again, whether it was beneficial, whether it would cure something, or whether it end up harmful, all depended on whether it was just the left or right-handed form of the molecule. So that's why I'm talking about this case of what's known as stereoisomers, because those two different versions of the medication were just different isomers. On a much less scary level, lemons and limes, you know, they smell differently from each other. Those are just different handed forms of the same chemical as well, limonene. That if limonene's in one of its form, it smells a little bit more like lemons, and if it's in its other form, it smells a little bit more like oranges. Why? Because what I was saying earlier about the way that the substance can interact with the body. If you've got receptors on your nose that detect a certain odor, and if molecules fit one way or another with those receptors, you're going to perceive different smells. Again, just comes down to a case of handedness. So that's another example of isomerization. So I want to move on to some other types of hydrocarbons. But before I do that, I want to define a term that I might have defined in the past here. Because in organic chemistry, there's a lot of reactions that have to do with what are known as functional groups. So a functional group is a set or a group of atoms that has the same reactivity regardless of the molecule it's found on. And as an example, here's another form of hydrocarbon known as an alkene. So that's a hydrocarbon that contains a carbon-carbon double bond. So if I write it out in line structure format, this would be an example of an alkene. Just to do a little bit of quick practice with interpreting line structures, let's write this out as a full structure once. Since there are three points on the compound, it's got three carbons in it. And the fact that the double bond is written in means that, yes, those two carbons have a double bond between them. If you're counting number hydrogens, double bonds do count twice. They're two independent connections between the atoms. So the rightmost carbon would only have two hydrogens on it because it's already got a double bond to the previous carbon. The middle carbon would only have one hydrogen on it, because the single and the double bonds would count for three for that middle carbon. And then the left carbon would have three hydrogens on it. So an alkene acts like an alkene acts like an alkene, no matter how large or small the molecule is. And so that's, in fact, how a lot of organic chemistry reactions work. They're used to transform one type of functional group into another with the based on the fact that functional groups tend to react the same no matter what kind of molecule that you find them on. So one type of alkene that you might have heard of before is a very simple compound that's just a carbon-carbon double bond where one of the carbons is also connected to a chlorine. Now, I'm trying not to get too technical with some of the examples I show. And what I mean is that there is a very complex naming system that we use for organic molecules. And your text even refers to this system. It's called the IUPAC system, I-U-P-A-C, the International Union of Pure and Applied Chemists. So they're an organization that amongst the things they do, one of the things they do, for example, is to come up with the standard atomic masses that we find on periodic tables. So they come up with numbers that are agreed upon pretty much worldwide. Same thing with naming compounds. The process of naming compounds is something called nomenclature. So this IUPAC group has a series of manuals that are used to come up with standard names of compounds. But a lot of compounds also have what are called common names. So this compound I just wrote down with the chlorine has the common name vinyl chloride. And there's a reaction that you can do that will link one molecule of vinyl chloride to another one, to another one, to another one, to another one, which creates a type of substance known as a polymer. So that's called polyvinyl chloride, or PVC. If you've ever heard of PVC pipes before, this is the starting material that's used to make PVC. So the starting material is an example of an alkene. And if you've never heard of PVC before, it's everywhere. So it's used in lots of applications. So alkenes are actually very widely used substances. Now, because of the structure of alkenes, there's another form of isomer that can come up. And so let me write these out in line structure format. We've talked a little bit about bonding, but there's a lot left to bonding theory we haven't had a chance to talk about. And so I'll just state a fact, and maybe later we'll get the chance to talk more about it. When you have a single bond between atoms, it is a single connection that ends up allowing atoms to independently rotate in that bond. And so at room temperature, if you have single bonds, those bonds are constantly rotating around, which of course you can't see from a still picture of a molecule on a page. But it turns out that with double bonds, that double connection prevents the atoms from being able to rotate relative to each other. So once you have a double bond, it locks that compound into place in terms of its structure. So one of these versions of this alkene I've just drawn has two carbons on either end, in one case where the two carbons are pointed the same direction as each other. In the other case, the two carbons are pointed in opposite directions of each other. So when the two carbons or the two attachments are pointed the same direction, this is what is known as the cis geometry. But if you have them pointed in opposite directions, then that's what's known as the trans geometry. So alkenes have a form of isomer that is created due to the fact that the atoms in a double bond, or that the geometry around a double bond, is locked into place. Now, I don't know how aware you all are, given your younger age, you may or may not be as concerned about some health issues as someone getting older like I might, but you might have heard about trans fats before, right? And trans fats, those are supposed to be unhealthier fats, right? Why is it? It's a question of geometry. Fats in general can end up accumulating in the bloodstream. And if they accumulate in blood vessels, then that's what eventually can lead to heart disease, the fact that you've got clogging going on in your blood vessels. Well, trans fats are fats that have these trans double bonds in them, where molecules have a sort of kink in the structure, which can make them larger in a sense and more able to clog up your vessels. Cis fats would have a different shape. They also have a different reactivity to them. It turns out that trans fats are less reactive than cis fats. So if you've ever heard of trans and cis in terms of fats or anything related to nutrition, it's exactly this difference in geometric format, this isomerization that occurs. Some of you might have also heard of saturated versus unsaturated fats, and that's related to terms that your book discusses as well, where saturated refers to an organic compound that only has single bonds, where unsaturated refers to a compound or an organic compound that contains double or triple bonds. So, again, referring to health a little bit, if you've ever heard of the difference between saturated fats and unsaturated fats, saturated fats are the ones that are worse for you. Why? Because carbon-carbon single bonds are not as reactive as carbon-carbon double bonds, even biologically. I referred to enzymes earlier, and it turns out it's easier for enzymes to chew up a fat that has a carbon-carbon double bond in it versus one that just has single bonds. Now, unfortunately, it turns out to be a lot of the single-bonded fats that are the tasty ones, and so that's why we have that out there. But if you hear someone referring to unsaturated fats, those are fats that have double bonds in them, which tend to be some of the healthier ones, like olive oil. One of the major constituents of olive oil is a long molecule that right in the middle has a carbon-carbon double bond, which means an enzyme could come along and chew that molecule up and make it later on less likely to clog up your blood vessels. So that's the difference between unsaturated compounds and saturated compounds. Now, how do you get from one to the other? You can react it with hydrogen. So if you react a unsaturated compound with hydrogen and a catalyst, it'll turn it into the saturated version. So if you ever read the back of food packages, and if you ever heard of partially hydrogenated oil, the hydrogenation is to turn that oil into to turn it into saturated fat, the stuff that's tastier but less healthy for you. So I know this is not a nutrition class, but I'm trying to make a link between these organic concepts and something that actually has some relevance out in the real world. So that's alkyne, or alkenes, things that have carbon-carbon double bonds. There's one last hydrocarbon, which is an alkyne. And that's a hydrocarbon that contains a carbon-carbon triple bond. Which triple bonds are like double bonds. They make a carbon compound more reactive than if you just had a single bond in it. The one triple bonded compound that you might have heard of before, its common name is acetylene. As in acetylene torches. So acetylene is the simplest alkyne, because it only contains two carbons in it. So there's an example of an alkyne very commonly used out in the real world. So we've run out of the different types of hydrocarbons. Much of the rest of the chapter talks about other functional groups. So I'd like to talk about a few of the functional groups today to again give some examples of where these substances show up in the real world. So I already showed you one functional group earlier, which is an alcohol. I talked about isopropyl alcohol or rubbing alcohol earlier. So an alcohol is an organic compound that contains an oxygen-hydrogen group. Now, you might be tempted to call that hydroxide, because that's what hydroxide is. It's oxygen-hydrogen by itself. But when oxygen connects to carbon, that's a covalent bond, not an ionic bond. So alcohols are not ionic substances. The OH in an alcohol has a very different behavior than hydroxide. That's important enough. I'm going to write that down as a note. When oxygen connects to carbon, it forms a covalent bond, not an ionic bond. And so, alcohols are therefore not ionic compounds. Now, as far as what kind of things might be on a quiz or an exam, I'm not going to make you memorize lists of chemicals. I do want you to know what some of the functional groups are. And that's why I'm going to give you some examples of chemicals, because there might be the one that sticks in your mind that you remember, oh yeah, that's an alcohol. So the simplest alcohol, it's not really easily possible, and you could do it, but the line structure looks kind of silly for the molecule. So that's if you have just one carbon in it. And that's called methanol. Now, let me explain a little bit about naming. Where these names came from, I'm not familiar with. It's one of those stories of chemical history that I probably should learn being a chemical instructor. But if you look at the number of carbons in an alkane, Methane is where you have one carbon, ethane is two, propane is three, butane is four. Any number past that, the names start turning into something that's systematic. So pent is a prefix meaning five. Hex is six. Hept is seven. So all the longer compounds have these regular names to them. It's the first four that are exceptions. So methane is an alkane that has one carbon in it. Now, that meth and methane, I mean, you've probably heard of methamphetamine before. That meth term just means a single carbon, which maybe later on I'll draw the structure of some of these things to explain where this terminology is used. But it's the same meth that's in methanol. Notice the ending of this name is an "ol," and that shows that this compound is an alcohol. Methanol is wood alcohol. Because wood used to be one of the sources used to produce the stuff. So methanol is a hazardous substance in that if you are exposed to it to too great a period of time, it can cause blindness. Which is why if you ever make your own alcoholic beverages, meaning not just mixing them, but making the alcohol, you have to be very careful about it. And if you ever go to parts of the country where they make moonshine, you got to make sure that their distillation process is good, because if it's not, it's going to have this wood alcohol in it, which means you drink it, you'll go blind. So a little bit of practical chemistry, if not chemistry that's in the lab. Of course, drinking alcohol is the two-carbon compound, ethanol. So that's sometimes called grain alcohol. And that is the stuff that's in alcoholic beverages. Now, I've been told that biologically, if you have even numbers of carbons, that we supposedly can ingest and process those just like ethanol. So I swear I had an instructor in the past that said that he'd drink in butanol, which is the four-carbon alcohol. I've never read up on the subject because you can do enough damage with just ethanol itself. But just telling stories about alcohols, the two-carbon alcohol is ethanol. I already showed you isopropyl alcohol earlier. That's rubbing alcohol. As far as other common alcohols, I'm trying to think if there's any one that you'd recognize. Let's see if your book's got any other examples. Oh, okay, there are two, yes. So I'm going to show you later on what a fat molecule is, but one of the parts that go into making a fat molecule is glycerol. So glycerol is a molecule that has multiple alcohol groups on the same molecule. So it's a three-carbon molecule that has three alcohols on it. There's one other molecule that's common enough that I'll show it to you. And it's got a common name to it. Its common name is ethylene glycol. Better known as antifreeze. So there are other antifreeze mixtures out there, but one of the most common ones that you would get if you went to an automotive store is one that's going to contain ethylene glycol in it. Just as a side story, if you have any pets and if you ever use antifreeze like this, make sure you don't spill it anywhere where a pet can come around, because pets perceive this stuff as tasting sweet, so they'll drink it up, but it's really toxic for them. So just as a public service announcement, that's why I wanted to say something about ethylene glycol. Yes? Because I guess habit of writing structures so that the OHs don't class with each other when you write them out. And it's because it's oxygen that's connected to the carbon. So the hydrogen's connected to the oxygen. So you write it however you can write it to make the structure look clear. And I guess I've been doing this enough years, I don't even think about it when I write it down. So it's because the oxygen's what's ended up connected. So one that's much more in the news these days, there is tetrahydrocannabinol, which is one of the active ingredients in marijuana. It also is technically an alcohol, which I don't have the structure memorized, but if we drew it out, it's got one of these OH groups in it as well. So there's another example of an alcohol. Now, moving on to another group. Which one do I want to talk about next? Oh, let's go in the order that your books got it. Ethers. So an ether is an organic compound with a carbon-oxygen-carbon group. So without getting too detailed, part of the reason that alcohols behave the way that they do is because of the oxygen-hydrogen bond. So if you take that away and put a carbon in instead, it makes that oxygen have a different behavior to it. And so that kind of a group is called an ether. Now, ethers, the most important, the most common one, is called diethyl ether. Let me explain something. You have ethane, which is a two-carbon compound. Ethyl, that ill ending, means it's what's known as a substituent. Which, let me explain what that word means. Substitute means to replace. Substituent means the thing that did the replacing. And so a substituent is a, how to define that quickly? It's a group of atoms that is substituted into a larger molecular structure. So if you put a two-carbon group onto something else, we indicate that in the name by changing it from ethane to ethyl. So diethyl means two-carbon groups. On what? In this case, an ether. So diethyl ether is an extremely common solvent. It really easily dissolves a lot of organic compounds. Historically, it was one of the first anesthetics. If you breathe this stuff in, it knocks you out. So it wasn't maybe the world's best anesthetic, but it was certainly better than nothing. In more modern terms, where you might have heard of diethyl ether is if you've ever heard about a meth lab blowing up in the news. Because usually the reason that happens is because people are using diethyl ether. Because it's really, really flammable stuff. If you open up a can of diethyl ether on this side of the room and leave it open for a while and then light a match at the back of the room, you might actually set it on fire up at this part of the room because the fumes would that pervasively fill up the class and the stuff is just that flammable. In fact, diethyl ether has the ability to auto-ignite, meaning that if you get it hot enough, and not that hot, but if you get it hot enough, it will just burst into flames without having to have any kind of external flame source.
What's considered that hot? Like if it's just 100 degrees outside?
Hold on, I can try to figure out.
Could you
It's 160 degrees Celsius. Well, but if, compared to a space heater, that's nothing. I mean, your ovens and ranges at home would get hotter than that even. So, again, back to the example of an illegal drug lab, if you got someone that's using the stuff not thinking about it, yeah, you light a match to smoke, and then boom. So that's, aside from the social issues caused by something like meth, which is, I mean, if you've got the list of drugs out there, that's at the top of one of the most destructive ones. Besides the physiological, sociological effect, making it involves chemicals like this that are hazardous. That's why if you've got a lab somewhere in your neighborhood, you want to be worried about it, not just because the crowd that's going to attract, but whether they're going to accidentally blow it up or not. I know that's not normally the type of thing you put in a textbook, but if you want to talk about real-life uses where this stuff shows up, that's unfortunately one of the places it shows up. It's also used all over in legitimate chemical labs because, like I said, it's a great solvent. It's a great thing for dissolving things because it does evaporate easily, and so it's easy to get rid of the solvent afterwards as well. Now, another functional group that shows up in a lot of common applications is the ketone. So that is an organic compound, one type of organic compound, with a carbon-oxygen double bond. Now, there are actually two groups, but I'll talk about ketones first. So I'll write something out in partially expanded form. So this is not a... question. So I had earlier said that, though not necessarily, I'm going to make you memorize the examples, but it helps if you could remember an example just to remember what the functional group is. So more directly, I'm going to ask about the different types of functional groups. So a ketone, one of the most common examples is this molecule here, which is acetone, which I don't know if you've ever heard of acetone before, but it's another fantastic solvent. And a place where acetone or related compounds would show up would be in something like nail polish remover. Very common place where, if not this particular ketone, then very related ketones. Another ketone that's very similar, methyl ethyl ketone. Add one carbon to one side here. That's what's in a lot of paint thinners or paint removers. If you go down to Home Depot and buy a can of the stuff, a large proportion of it may be something like acetone. So let me see if your text refers to other example ketones. Oh, well, it's got the two just like I've just mentioned. One of them is acetone. And I'll go ahead and draw the structure of this other one. So one side has got one carbon group, so that's methyl. The other side, it's got a two carbon group, so that's ethyl ketone, abbreviated MEK very commonly. And so both of these substances are very frequently used solvents. Now, something that's related is an aldehyde. That's an organic compound. With this carbon-oxygen double bond, but also a hydrogen attached to that carbon. So in a ketone, you only have carbons which are attached to the carbon-oxygen double bond. In aldehydes, you have a hydrogen that's attached as well. And there's quite a list of compounds that have aldehydes in them. One example. Is this compound called benzaldehyde? If you take almond oil and you extract out the different components of almond oil, one of those components is benzaldehyde. So, in fact, if you're allergic to almonds, this is a substance that you need to avoid because it's one of the things that causes that allergic reaction. Benzaldehyde and related compounds, though, can be used in perfumes. They might be used in food additives to give a certain flavor or smell to something. I'm not going to write the structure out, but there is the compound cinnamaldehyde, which you might guess is related to cinnamon. So, in fact, a large proportion of plants that might have particular flavors or particular odors to them, most of those have some small organic molecule that's got a functional group in it, that molecule is what's creating that particular flavor or smell. I'd have to look up, I've got a reference sheet for them, but there's lots of compounds that are ketones, that are aldehydes, that are alcohols, that fall into that category of plant-based substances or molecules that would be found in plants that give those plants their characteristic odors or tastes. I'm trying to think if there's any other aldehyde that's worth mentioning. Oh, well, an old one that used to be used a lot is formaldehyde. Many centuries ago, when I was a kid, one of the ways they used to preserve biological samples is by using formaldehyde. They don't tend to use it as much anymore, though, because formaldehyde has been found to be carcinogenic. So another random story based off of that is that in process of making certain types of fried foods, like French fries, they found that formamide or formaldehyde, both of those can be generated in that process. So I'm just mentioning that because if you see warning labels that are sometimes put out of, outside of places like fast food restaurants, you may see something like that mentioned in it. I saw a hand up for a question.
I saw that in my burn shirt. What would it have to do with that, the formaldehyde warning?
You found, saw it where? For formaldehyde. Like I said, formaldehyde's been found to be possibly a carcinogen, and formaldehyde might have been used in the manufacturing process. And so you might have furniture where some of this leaks out a little bit over time, and so they're probably required to have a warning label on it to say that there might be traces of this compound around.